Hi, it's Bob from Royal Spa. Soaking in a hot tub full of Epsom salts is the absolute best way to minimize everyday aches and pains. And we know all about Epsom salts at Royal Spa. Royal Spa hot tubs are the only hot tubs on the market that can safely and effectively use Epsom salts. Made right here in Indiana, Royal Spa hot tubs are the highest quality hot tubs on the market. Visit any one of our three Indianapolis locations or visit royalspa.com.
Ah, Royal Spa.
Eddie, you going with the Queen David Bowie version versus Vanilla Ice?
Yeah.
Probably a good call, because is Chris Ballard under pressure? Is that what we're saying?
Yes, sir.
Nah, he's good. He drafted Anthony Richardson. He's still got like 3 years.
I would agree with that. He punted that can another 5 years, right?
Yeah, I say that with not a lot of happiness, but hey, it's all right.
I mean, hey, good for him, right?
Yeah, hey. Got to respect it. Game recognized game, baby.
James Boyd, no stranger to the program, joins us now from The Athletic, talking about the NFL draft and the Colts. He has been previewing some of the possibilities for Indianapolis. Joins us on the show. James, how are you?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's get right to this. When you are looking through, I guess the first question I would have is, when looking through the Colts prospects in the draft, let's say pre-combine to now, in your opinion, has there been any wind of change in terms of areas that they may be targeting or areas that they now feel maybe are more shallow, that they have needs, and so therefore they need to address early as opposed to waiting until rounds 3 or 4? Or do you think it's been a pretty consistent board throughout?
I think it's been pretty consistent. However, I probably was leaning more towards offense before this first wave of free agency. But now they haven't signed a cornerback, I'm like, they probably are going to pick a cornerback in the first round. That's my, I guess, leaning. I'm not reporting anything, but I just feel like if you haven't upgraded that position at all, betting on Dallas Flowers and Jalen Jones to be one of the answers is not a bet I'm willing to place. I would much rather go draft Quinyon Mitchell or Tyrion Arnold or someone in the first round who could start from day one and be a guy.
James Boyd is our guest, covers the Colts for The Athletic. James, we always give you time to plug your stuff, but I'm going to do it early on the front end here because you retweeted something that always gets me jacked for NFL draft time, and that is, of course, if you have a subscription to The Athletic, and if you don't, you can get James's work, and plus you can get one of his colleagues, Dane Brugler, who every year puts out The Beast, which goes through every single position, in-depth breakdowns of not just team-centric guys, but we're talking the entire draft class from one all the way down to Mr. Irrelevant. So I want to phrase it this way, James. It's been 4 hours since he posted it, so let's assume that you've got a chance to look at some of it, even briefly. Where did you first go as a Colts beat writer? Did you go wide receiver? Did you go tight end? Did you look at cornerbacks? What was the first section of The Beast that drew James Boyd, beat writer for the Indianapolis Colts, to?
I went to the cornerbacks because I figured that's their biggest position of need. And, of course, I know the top guys, but I'm looking at, okay, who could be someone that they get if they trade back, or if they don't go cornerback round one, who's someone at round two or three they could possibly pick up? Because I do think that they're ultimately going to draft a cornerback on day one or day two. So I went there first. But even then, I think reading some of the background of these guys is always pretty intriguing to me. You know, reading about Brian Thomas Jr., who I think is a great player and will be a great pick for the Colts. He actually wasn't allowed to play football as a freshman, and his family, you know, forced him to play basketball because he was too skinny. And I'm like, I guess it worked out for you because you went back to football. Now you're going to be a first-round pick. So things like that is always interesting to me, is reading little nuggets that I probably can't Google or can't find on a stat sheet.
James Boyd is our guest from The Athletic. James, the guy that has been the most consistent from day one in terms of if he was on the board, the Colts would take him. And I want you to tell me, let's just say hypothetically, Chris Ballard's sitting there, clock's ticking, they're waiting for the card to turn in, and he's looking at it, and the best corner that he deems available is there, and Bowers, the tight end from Georgia, is there. He's writing down what?
Ooh. That's a good question. I'd probably say Bowers.
See, to me, it comes down to this, and I think you and I might have talked about this when you were in, when Jimmy was out losing his mortgage in Las Vegas. But
We went in the black.
Okay, fair enough.
Dang it.
At some point, doesn't the strategy become, James, if you have two players of need that are essentially that need is a tie, the tiebreaker should be which one has the greatest drop-off between themselves and what would be available at that position in the next round. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, and at tight end, it seems like, for example, the way I always say it, if Bowers is a 9 and a tight end that you would get in round 2 is an 8.2, you have a difference of a 0.8, and the best corner available is a 9, but you can get a corner in round 2 that's an 8.7, then you go with tight end, correct? Because you have less drop-off. Which of those positions, I guess, would be the one that is deeper?
I think that in this position, it will probably be, you know, if you're leaning towards cornerback or wide receiver, they're probably a little bit deeper than it would be for tight end. But I think it also goes back to how you would build your team and how much you trust Shane Steichen to work with whatever you give him. And I think if you give him a tight end like Brock Bowers, if he's still available, of course, that's someone I could see thriving in this system. And also, I think his floor is pretty high as well. I know you don't draft players that high for their floor, but I'm saying that because to me, there's very little room for him to be like a completely not good player. I think his ceiling is obviously to be a superstar, great tight end, you know, perennial Pro Bowler. But like his floor to me is to still be a really good player who might make one or two Pro Bowls, something like that. So that's always a factor in my head.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
James, it felt like the way things were trending in negotiations with different teams from Julian Blackmon, that in all likelihood, a reunion with the Colts, we talked about this last week, in a one-year variety would likely be the ultimate play that happens. It does happen that way. $7.7 million is the contract value, $3.2 million guaranteed. Where do you imagine things went from a negotiation standpoint with Blackmon to get to this point, and why is it a opportune situation for both sides on just a one-year deal that's likely a prove-it, get-me-over deal for Blackmon to sign elsewhere?
I think that early on, and he talks about this a little bit, but you expect your free agency to go one way, and then we saw this mass exodus of safeties, and a few of them were surprising. Like, you know, Justin Simmons got cut. Now, it was purely monetary, but he was cut after a second-team All-Pro season. And he's been, I believe, a four-time All-Pro in his career. So it's not like he's tapering off. He's 30. He's getting older. But that was a bit surprising. So when he hits the market, when you have Kyle Duggar, when you have, you know, other big-time safeties, that saturates the market and it creates a smaller market for you personally because you're kind of waiting for these other guys to get snapped up or get picked up and you can't maybe get what you would have wanted to because teams aren't as desperate to go after you because they have other options. And so I think that he was maybe a bit taken aback by that. And then it became a matter of, okay, I've talked to other teams. They're not offering me the long-term deal that maybe I would want. So if I'm going to bet on myself, I'll bet on myself with the team that just proved that they can use me and I can use them to have a great season. And so I think it goes two ways, like you said, Jimmy, where, you know, the Colts, in my opinion, another year of him in this system, and really it's just like, can he stay up? Can he stay healthy for 17 games for a full season? If he can't, then they have an answer on their end as to what do they want to do for their future. Yes, he's 25, but do you want to continue to, you know, bet on the guy who, you know, historically hasn't always been the healthiest in certain times of the season? And then for Julian, it's like, if I do prove that I can stay healthy for an entire year, play well again, then maybe I've earned your trust enough or earned someone's trust enough around the league to command a multi-year contract. Because he said yesterday, I believe I'm worth more than a one-year deal.
James, do you believe with Chris Ballard, James Boyd, our guest from The Athletic, I think one of the things that would be difficult in that position is the reality is you've got to block out the noise. And Chris Ballard has a job that it's a great job. He's very healthy compensation. But everybody is under the assumption they can do the job to his level, if not better, right? Human nature dictates, all of us within human nature, James, all of us are driven at times by doubters and proving those doubters wrong, right? But yeah. You have to have a fine balance of not having that be the motivating factor in a decision. Do you believe that Chris Ballard, I guess, has the right balance of blocking out those distractions? And is there any chance he is somebody that could be fueled or driven or misguided by overcoming naysayers and the motivation thereof?
I don't think that he would lean so far into that. Mainly because, I mean, I've had conversations with him both on and off the record about things that I've written or said about him. And, you know, he could be a guy that, you know, looks at me like I'm crazy. Like, what is this guy writing about? He's never done the job before. But I think that there's always been a two-way street to him understanding, okay, this is why I'm being criticized because I haven't done X, Y, Z. And so I do think that you can be motivated by that. But at the end of the day, I think that he's motivated by his own pitfalls, if you will, in this role. Again, no matter how you slice it, no matter what you look at in this league, most of the time, because there are exceptions to the rule, depending on, you know, relationships, things like that. But most of the time, 90% of the time, you're judged off your record, what you've done on Sundays and on game days. And for him, again, you don't have the division title. You have the two playoff appearances. You have one playoff win during the first 7 years of your tenure. And at some point, that's going to eat at you more than what anybody else could say, because they're saying these things because of that, if that makes sense. Like, it's not like we're jumping out and saying random things about you. We're saying this because it's a byproduct of what you've done or what you've lacked to accomplish during your tenure.
James, where do they go from here in terms of mapping out the rest of the draft after that first round pick? Because we know that it's either going to go, I mean, offensive or defensive seems too broad, but we know it's likely to be if Bowers is there or if they go high-level corner, that's their first-round pick. As you look at what they were able to do in free agency and what the rest of the draft board will unfold for them, where's your biggest need in any particular order?
Yeah, so I look at the different needs. Obviously, the three big ones, in my opinion, would be, you know, cornerback, wide receiver, and edge rusher. And I get it. I've gotten some pushback like, oh, what do you mean edge rusher? We need a safety, all these things. I look at what the great, great teams do, and they all usually have an elite edge rusher. Obviously, it helps to have a really, you know, great cornerback, really great wide receiver. But I would lean more towards edge rusher even still being a need over safety, because you saw the safety market this past offseason where teams are willing to kind of shore up that position with players that might be on 1 or 2 year deals or take a swing on a draft pick, whatever the case may be. They don't value that position as much as they do for an edge rusher. And obviously we see that with the competition and how guys get paid. So I think their board probably shakes out, you know, after those big three. You could always use more, you know, offensive line depth. You can always use another, you know, depth guy, the defensive line. But I even look at linebacker. I think that they're top heavy with their linebackers, but if you can get another guy in there with, for example, EJ Speedy is becoming a free agent next summer. If you can get a guy in here that could, you know, possibly replace him or, you know, work in tandem with him, depending on what you do with his contract. If you get another, linebacker in there that can cover, add some relief, that's a good decision. I think that Chris Ballard has been a good linebacker drafter throughout his career. And so I look at some of those needs throughout this team, and that kind of piques my interest. But, again, for me, I'm kind of just waiting and seeing what they do at cornerback, and if they pick a cornerback early, because if they don't, that means they're going to bet on Jalen Jones or Dallas Flowers. And again, if you bet on them and they hit Chris Ballard, I will write how genius of a move it was. But if you don't, I think you're going to hear a lot of criticism about that.
James, is there a position, James Boyd, our guest from The Athletic, is there a position that people may be surprised that the Colts kind of stockpile late in the draft, that you're going to go, wait a minute, they seem good at that position, but that Chris Ballard might have the foresight that they are a year or two from some people falling out of cycle, contractually, health-wise, whatever it may be, where they know they're ultimately going to have a couple of reserves, if you will, ready to go. And so, therefore, that security may come rounds 5, 6, 7 this year, and it would surprise people. What area would that be?
That's a good question. I think that one of them, like I said, will probably be linebacker. even though you're not in some like danger zone, you know, your linebacker core is getting a little bit older, and you wonder, okay, what is our ceiling with this group? I think another one that's kind of been underrated is the running back position. Obviously, you have Jonathan Taylor. Chris Ballard said he expects a huge year from him because he's finally going to be healthy. Obviously, no contract issue, things like that. But who's his backup? Are you sure it's going to be Trey Sermon? Or are you okay with that? Or are you okay with Evan Hull coming back from a season-ending injury last year? Or do you look at maybe adding another, you know, running back that can catch out of the backfield or add a little bit more to that room, give a little more diversity? I'm curious to see what they do with that position for sure, because I think that Zach Moss was an underrated loss.
Totally agree. I totally agree. Because let's just say hypothetically, James, knock on wood, but if Jonathan Taylor has to miss some time or some reps, that was such a valuable piece, right? Because you didn't miss a lot, and he kind of gave you a different look, a different wrinkle, if you will. That now falls on who? If Taylor's not there, that falls on who?
That falls on Trey Sermon right now. I think that he's the projected backup. When I look at the roster, I wouldn't trust, Evan Hull to be the backup after not playing, hardly at all last year. I think he appeared in one game. Obviously, Tyler Goodson is still on the roster, but I wouldn't expect him to be your number two running back. And so, yeah, Trey Sermon gets a lot of that workload. But again, he's kind of been a journeyman who really hasn't had it all come together in a season. So I wonder if the Colts would think about, on day three, drafting a running back they know because they could plug in there right away and he could be productive. So I'm curious about that. And also, again, just on a tangent, I do expect JT to bounce back, but you do wonder, okay, for the past 2 years, he's kind of been dinged up. And, of course, you expect him still at a very young age, I think he's 25, to, be healthy, be productive, but just – common sense would tell you the older you get, the position he plays, the likelihood of him getting healthier later is not likely. And so you have to, build in some contingency plans just in case, again, he has to miss an extended period of time.
James, you highlighted half of my last question for you. Jonathan Taylor's injury history, or the fear of him getting injured, combined with Anthony Richardson's short history, but albeit injury-filled rookie season, that was the tandem that was expected going into last year to electrify the Colts offense and keep teams guessing, because if you run option or whatever with those two guys, what poison are you picking? Do you imagine that style is tempered back due to both of those injury concerns with both players we outlined?
I don't think so, because I think that if you do that, you're going to limit what you can become. And I'm not saying you go out there and you be reckless. You have to be calculated. You have to be smart. But, again, you can't take yourself out of the running before you see what you're capable of, in my opinion. And all that to say, some fancy way of saying, give the ball to your best players and trust that they can lift this team. Because you look at, again, this offseason, you haven't made really any changes. The only change you're expecting or you're betting on is for Anthony Richardson to come back, be fully healthy, play the entire season, and take a significant leap, and then also JT come back, be fully healthy, play the majority of the season, hopefully the entire season, and make that jump together. Because I know we've hyped up, Houston, I've done it, the additions they've made, the Titans, the Jaguars are still there. For the Colts, your biggest offseason additions have been your two main players just being healthy and being available and hopefully getting some time to practice together. Because, you look at what they did last year, I think that JT and Anthony Richardson were on the field for two snaps together last year. That's it. And obviously they didn't practice hardly together, no training camp. So you just wonder, with both of them being healthy, no contract disputes, can they build some chemistry and then build with this team and try to go for it? Because I think that this is a window that is, dwindling a little bit, you're not the Jaguars with, Trevor Lawrence going to the final year of his rookie deal. But again, you do want to have some urgency and try to go for it.
And again, The Athletic is where you can read all of James' work. You go to the NFL tab and then under teams for the Colts, all of the articles, including the Colts pre-draft depth chart look from James, an article about Anthony Richardson and what the Colts are doing to build him up as other teams in the AFC South lift their quarterbacks, and then, of course, draft previews as well. James, appreciate the time as always. And inevitably is the wrong way of saying it, but surely we'll talk to you between now and the draft. Appreciate it.
Sounds good. Thanks for having me.
All right, James Boyd of The Athletic.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Pacers, the big win last night over the Toronto Raptors to firmly continue control of their destiny for a six seed or better finish to the NBA regular season heading into the playoffs. 141-23 winners over the Toronto Raptors. Covering it all as he joins us quite a bit here on these airways is Scott Agnes of Fieldhouse Files. Scott, how are you?
Hey, Jimmy. Good to be on with you. Can't believe final week of the season. Two games left. Like, that's where we're at right now.
Scott, for your perspective on Tyrese Halliburton, and Jake talked about this earlier, does it feel like in your mind over the last four or five games that he is rounding back into form, whether it's more comfortability with Pascal Siakam and everybody at full strength, whether it is just him breaking out of his slump? Where have you seen over the last four or five him getting back to the form that we saw so critical to their run in the play-in that would also be so critical to a deep run in the playoffs?
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. And I think this is more about him than others or his teammates and things like that. First of all, I think that mental blockage just from just the fatigue factor, I think, is behind him. And that's in large part, I think, to some days off. Like right now, they're back in Indy. They won't fly out again until tomorrow, then play. And it's a short, you know, probably an hour flight, if that, to Cleveland. So a break in the schedule, no more back-to-backs here in the last couple of weeks have been helpful. You can just see it first with his body language and then with his play on the court. He's smiling again. We're seeing the Halliburton skip. Those are all good factors for him. And on top of that, he's starting to knock down those three-point shots. He's had two in each of the last nine games now, which is huge. And then last night in particular, up in Toronto, that was his best offensive performance since his injury in January, several months ago. So at the right time, he's looking as healthy as he could be, probably until an offseason where he can really lay off that hamstring.
It is a 46-minute in-air flight from Indianapolis to Cleveland, Scott. Do you know the only problem with that 46-minute flight from Indianapolis to Cleveland?
What's that?
When it ends, you're in Cleveland. That's the Cleveland actually underrated.
Come on.
Cleveland's actually
I don't
underrated.
Mind Cleveland.
I've had fun times in Cleveland, actually, to be honest with you.
Yeah, Jake, I don't mind it at all. There's a nice little district that kind of reminds me of a Georgia Street or a Mass Ave, kind of just west, I think it is, of the stadium. There's a casino opportunity. You have a baseball park right there. My only thing is that almost seemingly any time you are there, it is dark, overcast, and a little breezy.
I'd agree.
Right,
the weather's not great. But I had a buddy that right out of college, he had a choice between working in Chicago or Cleveland. And he's like, you know what? Everybody goes to Chicago. I'll go to Cleveland. So we went and visited, and I mean, it was a cool town. We had fun there, to be fair, and I have good friends there. But it's an easy city to knock on. Okay, Scott, I want to get into this last night and dive into it a little deeper. Was it simply matchup situational? Was it a concerted effort to uncork? What exactly got into Obi Toppin last night? Because I thought he was outstanding.
Yeah, he really was. What I think the biggest thing was in the second half, they were getting back to their playing style, getting out and running and getting those transition points, and that's where he's out at his best. Again, that is why they brought him and Bruce Brown in originally at the beginning of the season, is because what they could accomplish on the run there in transition. So I think they got back to that. And when the opponent, like Toronto, wasn't making shots and scoring at ease like they were in that first quarter, then you're not always taking it out of the net. And then you're able to get down and play more of that full court offense. I think one area come the playoffs that will be interesting to see is what this team looks like when things slow down, when there's longer possessions, when you get into your half court offense. Because that's an area that the Pacers traditionally have not been good at. That's something that Tyrese Halliburton talked about with us at the draft combine last year. As he was watching the postseason, the game has slowed down. He was texting with the assistant coaches, ways in which maybe they need to work on that. But I think we've also seen Jake on Toppin is he's gotten more and more comfortable now this deep into the season with personnel, with his role in particular. I think fans would be stunned to find out that he's among the Pacers' best three-point shooters on the team this season and what he's been able to do. And since the All-Star break, it's been McConnell at 60% and he at 42%. That's a great thing. Now, on the other side of that, one concern also for me coming in during the postseason is you need your guards. You need those wings to knock down three-pointers, and that's something I'd like to see them work on.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
Scott Agnes of Fieldhouse Files is our guest. Scott, you brought up TJ McConnell. He's been outstanding throughout the entirety of the season, but especially the last month, month and a half, where he's able to take that second unit by the horns and at times not just keep things level, but extend leads for the Pacers. Why do you think, and I know Malik Monk is probably going to be the runaway winner, but why do you think he has not garnered the national awards attention of Sixth Man of the Year consideration?
Yeah, I appreciate you asking that. I wrote about that yesterday at Fieldhouse Files, how if you're watching the Pacers and understand their dynamic, you know just how critical TJ has been to this team. There's probably a handful of games here post All-Star break where he both kept them in it and gave them a chance to win. When that starting group got him off to a bad start, he came in, saved them. And what he's been able to do again post All-Star break, he's been their most consistent player. He's averaging 14 points per game. Remember, like, coming in, like, you expect him to assist, maybe five assists and a couple of baskets if there's something open. Now he's changed the dynamic where you want him taking shots. And I think he's done a tremendous job probably throughout his career just adapting and making do with what he can. And right now, over the last couple of years, it's been the addition of being able to knock down a three-pointer when left open. But more specifically, that kind of fadeaway 8-foot, 10-foot jumper where he goes up and kind of fades away from the defense where guys really struggle and don't have success blocking him. But, yeah, I think – TJ should absolutely be in consideration for Sixth Man of the Year. I think his consideration probably should have picked up the last couple of months. I can understand why he's not in the conversation the first few months. And also, the biggest thing is how many people are keeping tabs right on Sixth Man across the league. And so, generally, people are probably going to points and looking for that 20-point score off the bench, like a Russell Westbrook or someone who's eye-popping, and that's where they lean on.
Scott, in the playoffs itself, Scott Agnes is our guest, Fieldhouse Files, joining us on the show here. You know, it's hard to remember this, but if we were to go back and look at the Pacers at the beginning of the year, I think the expectation of the hope was, hey, get into the playoffs, play a series, and play in some meaningful games and learn from that. Like, I look back to when, and I'm going back a million years ago, but you know, when Oladipo first kind of broke through, if you recall, and they went like seven games against Cleveland. And that was a real learning block for them, right? And then obviously things kind of went south from there. But it feels like with this group at the beginning of the year, that would have been sufficient of like, that's what this group needs. But now that we know they can compete, does the narrative change? I know they want to win a playoff series, don't get me wrong, but what I'm getting at is, if the dust settles and they lose in round one in six or seven games, can we chalk that as a long-term victory?
I think so, Jake, just because they've been out of the postseason since 2020. They've had two coaches since they've been in the postseason. So you're right. The players all talked about how getting to the postseason and experiencing some of that was the goal. And I think it became the demand once you get a guy like Pascal Siakam. If it would have been a failure if they are in a top six seed and Siakam was acquired at the trade deadline, I think it's critical for the development of this team, for the experience of this team, to get a taste of it. But you do look and how jam-packed the standings are, we're not so sure they'll sit at six. They have a chance here, win a couple, their last couple of games, could move up a spot or two. Maybe you have the 4-5 seed with facing Orlando or Cleveland potentially. And then on top of that, every team right there outside of Boston has its flaws. Milwaukee not playing well at all right now at the 2 seed. I don't trust them in the playoffs, though you do know that Dame and Giannis have that experience. The Knicks will be without Julius Randle. OG's been battling the health concern the last couple of months. What's his availability? Orlando, much like the Pacers, don't have that playoff experience, so you could see it go either way. And the Cavs, I don't think you can trust them. The rumor mill seemingly has Donovan Mitchell going elsewhere at the end of the season. What do they look like? I don't think it would be a failure by any means for them to get to the postseason and lose in round one. But because of the way it's set up, in the way in which they play competitively in games that matter, good teams, I think you should be encouraged by their prospects of reaching round two.
Scott Agnes, Pacers beat writer for Fieldhouse Files, joins us. Scott, the rotation has continued to amaze me at times because you figure that they're going to tighten things and it's going to be a clear eight-man set, and these are the eight guys or eight or nine guys, and that's what we're rolling with. By the time we get to the end of the regular season, two games from now, do you envision that there is a clear eight, nine set in stone pieces of this is it and the other couple guys on the bench, sorry about you? Or do you imagine it is this hybrid look where based on matchup is who is added into the bench rotation?
Yeah, I think it's pretty well set for the most part with a nine man, with McDermott being kind of a fringe inside out, depending on what they need, if they need shooting, etc. But I could also see you go into the playoffs, you face Cleveland with a couple bigs there up top, then maybe you stretch it out and maybe even the 10th man instead of McDermott, it becomes a Isaiah Jackson, for example. But I think we've seen how even pre-McDermott injury, it seems like it's a nine-man rotation with McDermott occasionally getting some minutes in. And that would be huge if he could come in and knock down at least a couple of threes in a 10-minute stint come the postseason. Anything more than 9 or 10, you are really pushing it. You'd really like to stay at 9, I think, and give guys more minutes, especially as you need guys like Nesmith to be productive on both ends. Nembhard, you'd like to see him a little bit more productive on the offensive end.
Scott, I think I might have asked you this before. Scott Agnes, our guest, but I want to revisit it. I think it's worth revisiting, you know, each month, especially as we head towards the end of the year. I think Jalen Smith has continued to, when his number has called, play well. Might have struggled a little bit like midseason, but now that he's getting consistent minutes, you know, he's showing, obviously, why he's in the rotation. Has he priced himself out of being able to be retained by Indiana?
Well, first of all, he'll have to decide on his player
option. Well, he has a player option, right? He is going to say whether or not he wants to come back, right?
Yeah, so first of all, there is that option. It's at $5.4 million. It'd be, you know, is there teams out there looking to pay him $7, $8, $9? And then it also, of course, Jake, becomes what does he want to do? Because he knows his role right now. He knows Rick Carlisle's belief in him. He knows what kind of minutes that he's going to be getting a night in and night basis from this situation. That's a reason he kind of bought into it, even having to take a pay cut. He had a couple better offers out there, I was told, in free agency back in 2022. But remember, he blew up here after being acquired and I was shooting crazy from 3-point land, like 50%. I don't think he has, but I think he'll have to make a decision of, is he good where he's at right now? But also understanding, hey, look, too, sooner or later, the Pacers will have to make another decision what they do at starting center with Miles. He'll have just one more year under contract. And Isaiah Jackson, the same way, he's on the final year of his rookie deal next year. So it could be a chance where Jalen succeeds Miles after that. Maybe they re-sign Miles. But I think he's content and he's comfortable within his skin and in his role, I would say, more than ever this season. And that's why he's really been able to thrive.
No secret on this show, I love Isaiah Jackson.
Yeah.
Because he just brings something that nobody else on that roster seems to bring. And he's ready every time his number seemingly is called. Question is he that guy if, like, at some point his role is going to have to be elevated, right, long-term? Can he put up that kind of production if he's getting significant long-term minutes, or is it just because we're seeing him in short bursts?
I think he could be a really good backup, dependable center in this league. I haven't seen enough to believe that, hey, he can be a 32-minute guy every single night, just because we really haven't seen that from him. The biggest area I think he's improved, much like the younger guys once they mature, is he couldn't come in for a minute in previous years and not foul. He hasn't picked up the foul trouble, and also he continues to rebound at a better clip. Like, again, the Toronto Raptors, undermanned, sitting guys, their season's over. They want to lose to lock in a top six draft pick here. But at the same time, Isaiah coming in with something to play for, grabbed 7 rebounds in 18 minutes. Like, those are the little encouraging things. And then on top of that, as you mentioned, Jake, the dynamic, his ability to run and finish lobs. Like, this team never was good at dunking until the last couple of years, and now they're one of the has the highest rate at dunking, as we saw last night with Isaiah and Obi Toppin in particular, too. So to answer your question, I think I'm not sure he's a starter caliber player, but I definitely think he's a backup. And let's say Jalen moves on next year, just hypothetically, I would have no short in confidence that Isaiah would step up and fill that role nicely.
Scott, where do you see the biggest matchup problems on either side, both for Cleveland and Indiana, when you look at what is effectively a potential playoff preview? Because if I'm not mistaken there, if Cleveland does win, there's still an avenue where it could be 3-6 Pacers, Cavs. What do you see from this early potential preview matchup between these two Central Division foes?
Yeah, well, first of all, the Cavs have a player who's been there, done that, and Donovan Mitchell. So that's always a little bit scary and something that concerns you. And on top of that, the Pacers, while they have Nesmith and Nembhard, I still don't think they have that elite defender that you are just very comfortable throwing him on anyone knowing he can be that stopper. Pascal Siakam at sometimes has taken on the greater workload defensively as well in matchups, and he prevents a little bit different problems just because of his length. So Mitchell is a little bit concerning. The bigs inside with Jaren Allen, Evan Mobley, that's a different look than – and so it's two competing styles, right? Pacers are trying to run, play fast, and shoot a lot and knock down threes. The Cavaliers, meanwhile, more of an inside style. And from the Cavaliers' standpoint, can they keep up with that pace? Who guards Siakam for them would be something of concern, I think, when it comes to that. And then also the Pacers have played the Cavs really well. Now, they haven't seen them lately, but I remember earlier in the season they played them like twice in the first six games. Pacers won both of those meetings. They scored in high clips. Miles Turner had success as they kind of left him open and knocked down shots in the way in which the Cavaliers chose to guard him. So I like that much matchup. It doesn't scare me as much as necessarily maybe another one does, like the Knicks, even though they don't have Brunson, and the Magic are much like Toronto in those new modern style construction of teams just with length and athleticism at every position.
Scott, how would you assess, if any, I guess, the evolution or the improvement since acquisition of Pascal Siakam defensively?
Honestly, my first thought is to be determined. I still need to see more, I think, from that side of it. I think offensively, he's gotten more comfortable. He's asserted himself more, and I'd still like to see even more of that, in fact. Like, when the team's falling behind in 10 points early on, I'd like to see him take over and say, nope, we're not doing this. I got this. Defensively, I know we're about 39 games into him being with this roster and being able to settle in. I think he's been fine. I don't think it's been elite by any means, but I'm not sure they were necessarily expecting that as well.
You know, the offensively in terms of – you know, now it's been, you know, it's been long enough with Siakam. Scott, do you feel like that offense is starting to kind of flow again? Because it did. I think when he was first acquired, just naturally speaking, the offense was slowing down because you had parts that were just not used to moving along with one another, right? And now all of a sudden there is more familiarity. What percentage of pace offensively do you think they are versus where they ultimately need and will be?
Yeah, I would say with this current iteration, they're probably about 90% of what they're trying to do and get accomplished. The challenge for this group in its totality has just been the different iterations of this team, right? Early on, you were talking about sprinting up the floor because you had Bruce Brown and Obi Toppin. Toppin was in the starting lineup. Then you move on from Bruce Brown. Then you move on from Buddy Hield. Tyrese loses that safety net, that three-point threat in Buddy Hield, and their three-point attempts are down, three-point percentage. What they're getting from the three-point line in general is down, and that is something of note and concern, I think, entering the postseason. They continue to excel in the paint. Pascal's taking more shots. He now leads the team in field goal attempts at about 16 per game post-All-Star break. I think that's good, but then you lose Benedict Mathurin. So it's a whole different iteration, and they're going to miss him in the playoffs for his, you know, his toughness, how hard he plays. And he was the best player on this roster at getting to the free throw line, although I think Siakam can help alleviate that a little bit. He's not getting the free throws he was getting in Toronto. Pacers are one of the lowest free throw shooting teams in the NBA. Siakam can help in that department. And I think having a full offseason, coming off a postseason run, assuming he re-signs, which is the plan for both sides, then you hope that can take off and ideally consolidate the roster even more and add ideally a 3-and-D guy like we continue to be talking about as well.
Scott, if Robin the Genie gave you Boston or the field in the East, which do you take?
Boston, and it's not even close.
Okay. If Robin the Genie gave you Boston or the field in the West, who do you take?
I think right now I'd just take the field because I still see Denver right there looming. Jokic, best player in the league. And there is a little hesitation come the big game. Can the Celtics close it off? Can they finish it off? The Nuggets been there, done that. But out of the East, I would have zero questions about Boston coming out. I think only injuries will slow Boston down.
Speaking of Nuggets, let me throw one at you, and then you tell me how crazy I am, okay? If Boston were to win it this year, Brad Stevens gets the itch to begin coaching again. Your thoughts?
Too soon. I think it's too soon. I think it would be once his kids are out of the house.
Well, that's true. That's 2 years away, right?
Something like that. Yep. Yeah, I think he has a daughter that's maybe a freshman or sophomore, it seems like. I don't think it'd even be in consideration from there. Then it would just decide. It'd be one of those, hey, I wanted to be an exec. I proved what I could do. It helped me at home and my lifestyle there. And now do I have an itch to do something else? My understanding is he loves it. He's content exactly where he is.
Well, but I would have agreed with that, Scott, for a long time. Okay. And I've laughed at it, right? I've laughed at the whole, like, I'm like, he's in the NBA as an official, an executive. And I don't think that I don't think he has an eye on leaving, but I think he's starting to feel the itch just a little bit. And that would, okay. That yeah. That would, you know how when you get poison ivy, you scratch it and then it itches even more?
Yeah, absolutely.
I feel like maybe like the hive is there and the itch hasn't started, but winning a championship, suddenly it's like you scratch it the first time.
I would not be surprised, Jake. I just think it'd need to be 3 to 5 years down the road. I would be stunned if it was in the next couple of years.
I'll agree, but I'll agree with you, but I'll say, and listen, I laughed forever at fans that would say this stuff, okay? But I'm starting to think a little bit, but I'll say 2 to 3. I'll agree with you, but I'll say 2 to 3, but we shall see. This is why we have Sports Talk Radio.
I've got the over on that, Jake.
Okay.
He is Scott Agnes of Fieldhouse Files, covering the Pacers all season long and especially down the stretch run here. Scott, I know you mentioned the Sixth Man of the Year conversation piece, but anything else you've got in the works with 2 games to go?
Yeah, one piece I'm writing about is what's going on what has gone on up in Westfield. It's a little side story, but I think it's kind of cool that Trey Buchanan, the GM, Chad Buchanan's son was up there, Anthony Richardson's brother's up there. We saw the Colts general manager Chris Ballard's son was the quarterback up there. So I went up to a game this season to watch Trey Buchanan and follow his game. And that'll be a fun story I'm working on top of just looking ahead to the postseason here and what's to come. And then coming up also a little side thing is on Sunday, Miles Turner will have a special outfit designed by an Indiana University student. Tyrese Halliburton did that last year. Miles Turner got involved this year, so I'll have a story about that as well for the season finale.
So that wasn't the pajamas that Tyrese Halliburton was wearing last night?
It was not, no.
I think he was wearing – he looked like – you know how sometimes you go to Walmart and you see somebody walking around in SpongeBob SquarePants pajamas and shoes like Eddie's wearing, and you're like, what are we doing here? What
are those shoes called, Eddie? They didn't want to go out, but they had to go get that one more thing.
Exactly.
To complete the order. They
throw on the Crocs
and cleaning supplies.
Pair of fleece pants.
Hey Dudes?
Those are Hey Dudes? Okay,
yes.
Those aren't bad. I thought you had on Crocs. Don't you wear Crocs every once in a while?
Very, very rare.
Do you wear Crocs with socks?
No.
Scott, I consider socks with sandals a violation unless you're in Europe. Your thoughts?
I would agree, although you do see a lot of that in basketball in general, right? You just finished playing the game.
Well, not necessarily slides. I'm talking about, like, if you're wearing Birkenstocks with socks, German, then, like, no. Not happening.
Yeah, that's a huge red flag.
Totally agree. Scott, we appreciate the time, as always.
Likewise. Thanks, guys.
Scott Agnes joining us on the show.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
It's a perfect day in Augusta.
Such a beautiful sound.
I'm telling you right now.
Hello, friends.
Okay, this right here, these are dulcet tones, right? These are soothing sounds. That's what my guy sounds like entering Augusta.
Just the aura around him?
This time, a week from now, my guy's going to sound like Metallica and Gigi Allen. Just an absolute, like, not even a, I mean, you think brush fire. My guy is about to take off, and when my guy wins the Masters, people are going to say, and you mark my words, and what do they say about, what does Mike Damone, Ratner say to Mike Damone, Eddie? You know, when they say that Damone's a loudmouth, and they say that a lot, right? With me, people say that I'm Nostradamus, and they say that a lot. They're going to be saying it again when this guy wins the Masters, and they're going to go, that Query guy, I'll tell you what, he is.
You just don't know him like I do.
That's right. Will Haskett joins us on the program to talk about the Masters. He is, of course, Indianapolis's foremost expert when it comes to the PGA. Joins us now. Will, do you have your pick on who's going to win the Masters?
You know, it's weird. I don't, because it's been such a strange lead up to it, with talent kind of splintered in the world of golf and Scottie Scheffler being so dominant in the space that it's really hard, I think, to just say, oh yeah, here are my three or four guys, or here's my one guy, because you have to sort of asterisk every pick and say, well, if Scottie Scheffler doesn't win, then I guess this is my guy. Because we've reached that rarefied time in a golfer's, you know, I guess, apex, where it's he versus the field. We don't get him versus the field very often, and we're pretty close to it right now with the way Scottie Scheffler's playing golf.
Well, so that was going to lead. Okay, before we get to that, and I'm going to ask Will, and I apologize for asking.
I do have a pick, by the way, so you can wait till the end if you want an additional pick to him.
Now listen, if it's my guy, then you've got to have a second pick, because I'm the only one allowed to have my guy, because my guy is going to win it.
Got it.
Just so you know.
You know, Langer's not in the field. He blew his Achilles.
What's that?
Can't go with, you know, Langer blew his Achilles, so he's not back.
My guy has no Achilles. That's the thing, right? I mean, I'm telling you, there's no flaw.
I feel like you're about to break into a version of Sister Act, but my guy, and it's going to be about your golfer every time you keep saying this over and over again.
Listen, you guys laugh now, and then all I got to say is just prepare yourself, right? Prepare yourself. Will, before we get into talking about the Masters, and I apologize for asking the simplistic and what is probably obvious to people that follow golf avidly, but for those like myself that are basically, you know, the majors followers,
yep,
I am a little bit confused, and then you tell me if I'm just totally in the dark here, about where things stand in terms of the alleged merger with LIV and the dissolve of that and everything else and the different golfers in different series. I thought it was all going to be under one umbrella, but it seems like that has stalled. Or am I just completely out to lunch because I'm paying way too much attention to, like, my guy who is, you know, shooting 60s other places?
No, you're right. It has completely stalled. I think that there's so much that has to come together and so many contracts and promises and guarantees that the ability to snap fingers and make this happen seamlessly overnight, we now realize, is next to impossible. There are continuing conversations. They happen a lot slower, and there's a lot of time between those conversations, or more time than I think most fans and members of the media would like to have happen. So it's a very slow churning train towards resolution. And the problem is that golf has lost a chunk of its fan base in the wake of that train. And I don't know if we'll ever get them back, to be honest. I you know, if you want to get really nerdy about it, Jake, this is the most watched golf event of the year. A lot of people only watch the Masters, and, you know, no disrespect to the other three majors. Like, this is a big week. If we have a halfway decent leaderboard and it looks like we're going to have good weather on the weekend, I am very intrigued by the ratings on Sunday, because if the Masters ratings are down the way that ratings across the board are down in professional golf, or even if they're down half the level of it
then all of golf has to realize we've got a problem here. Because if people aren't watching the Masters because they're so turned off by the greed and the separation and the – it's not even – we don't even have the circus show of last year, which is, you know, PGA Tour versus LIV. Like, all these guys are singing this kumbaya, we need to come back together for the good of the sport, and they're saying it on their giant mountains of money. But if the Masters ratings are down this weekend, like if Tiger makes the cut and the Masters ratings are still down this weekend, then we have a serious problem. It is time to sound the alarm.
And this is, I mean, to put it in local language, as we've talked about before, Will, I mean, this kind
of 500. It's the split. It's the correct. IRL cart split all over.
Correct.
It's the exact, it is as close to that. I mean, it's crazy to be a professional golf broadcaster who's lived my entire life in Indianapolis, because I have lived this. I've seen this movie before. I know how it ends.
It is. And so with that, the other thing is this, and pardon my naivete of this question, but somebody that has been playing primarily LIV golf and then playing in a major, are the different courses and the different scoring methods, et cetera, in any way, shape, or form affecting the way, like a rust settle of playing in then a PGA event, if that's not the dumbest question you've ever been asked?
No, so they made their domestic debut, or I guess they came back to the United States to live last week. They played in Doral down in Florida, which is a really hard golf course, in anticipation of these guys sort of saying, hey, look, we don't want to be rusty going into a major. So they addressed that in the way that they built their schedule. So we shouldn't have that same talking point. I think the larger talking point is you're playing smaller fields. You're playing 54 holes instead of 72 holes. You're playing for mountains of money when you're already guaranteed mountains of money. Is there really a competitive spirit? And I think that's the reason why a lot of the traditional golf audience hasn't gone to watch LIV, is they just don't feel there's any juice there. There's no emotion. There isn't legacy and things to play for beyond the crazy sums of cash that they're paying for. And so I think that that's the one thing we still can't answer is, does LIV golf prepare guys to play in high leverage, pressure packed tournaments? But they have so many elite players over there that, you know, can, you know, John Rahm said it yesterday in his press conference. Yes, he's played less golf this year, but he can still prepare for a tournament the way in a major, the way that he's always prepared. So I think it's a negligible gap between those on LIV and those in the PGA Tour in terms of their readiness. And LIV has also done a few things to make sure that they aren't rusty arriving at Augusta this week. But I think at this point in time, you have the choice whether you want to be rusty or not. If you want to be big, fat, and happy, you can on LIV. It doesn't matter. You know, you can finish 20th out there every single week with no consequence, unlike you can't do that on the PGA Tour. So that's a broader or longer, I guess, study than this week. But again, we're so far removed from a year ago when, you know, if anybody watched the Netflix show, you know, Full Swing, the first episode, they made it into this crazy, like it was LIV versus the PGA Tour this time a year ago, which I think was overblowing it a little bit. But now that we're a year away from it, it seems silly because all the guys are, they're not talking like that anymore. None of the players view it as us versus them. It's just, we have two tours now and they only come together four times a year.
Will Haskett of PGA Tour Radio with us. Will, you mentioned this throughout the back and forth there with Jake, but just as one of the key questions I want to get to you with, there are a lot of layers, especially at Augusta, to the Tiger Woods conversation. So a couple that you can take in any order. Will he make the cut? Will he finish the entire tournament? Like, he will make it from round one to round four without having to withdraw. And if we're dreaming a giddy dream, is it possible to put together another 2019 improbable type of the stars align and he's putting on another green jacket?
So Tiger's own words yesterday were, if everything falls my way, then I can still win this golf tournament. And I think that compared to a lot of other players in the tournament, there are a few more things on that list that have to fall his way than Scottie Scheffler. Like, Scottie Scheffler shows up and plays good Scottie Scheffler golf, he wins the golf tournament. That's the list. Check mark right here. Play as good as you can, win. Tiger, it's play unbelievably well. Have some guys not play as well. Have your body cooperate. You know, all of these things that go into it. I think it's beneficial to him that he got a late tee time, because tomorrow looks like a real washout. There's a massive line of storms that's working through the south and going to the southeast that's supposed to arrive on property sometime tomorrow morning. So the fact that he already was going to be out late, I think he doesn't have to worry about revving things up and then starting and stopping, which could be a bit of a problem. But the body is the big answer. After hearing him talk yesterday, he seems to be in good spirits, comfortable with his body to be able to give it a go. He obviously has an incredible streak here of when he has played, of being able to make the cuts. Now, we've seen him obviously bow out when it comes to, you know, the weekend, but, you know, he has never missed a cut since he was an amateur. Last time he missed a cut was in 1996. So if he's going to tee it up and continue this streak, I think he can make the cut. Will his body get him all the way through Sunday? That's a huge question mark. But if we take him at his word, then he thinks that he can. And if anybody's proven us wrong, it's been Tiger Woods before. Can he win the golf tournament? Like, I've been burned in the past. I was burned before 2019 saying, I don't think he can win another major. And I've prefaced this by saying, I don't think he can win another major because since he proved us wrong in 2019, he rolled a car down the hill and had, you know, three more reconstructive sort of surgeries. It takes a lot. Like he said yesterday, a lot has to fall into place, but small field course history matters. No one knows it better than Tiger. I think he can make the cut, and Jimmy, you'll appreciate this one. He was plus 120 yesterday to make the cut. He's minus 115 now. So the money is going towards Tiger making the cut right now.
Well, that's where my money will be. So
that's
thank you
shock.
For that nugget. I appreciate it.
Well, I mean, yep. If you want to throw money away, that's fine. And if you want to invest,
well, I'm going to make it back. So I'm going to follow you on your guy.
Well, I've got Monopoly on my guy.
Oh, okay.
Will, give me, so we'll do this in two parts. The first is this from Will Haskett. Give me a player going into the Masters that is seen by both reputation and everything else as, you know, a legitimate favorite, but you have some pause just because lately maybe you have seen something where there might be something going on with their game and there could be potential for a slide. That would be who?
Rory McIlroy. He finished third last week in San Antonio. I was there. It was a really good performance from Rory. It was his first top 10 of the season on the PGA Tour. He did win on the DP World Tour, the European Tour earlier this year. But this is the monkey right now. You know, this is the one that's keeping him from the career Grand Slam. And there's still so much talk around Rory because of that, that I really wonder how much. Now, he's completely dialed in his schedule differently this year. He arrived late. He's not playing in the par three today. He's trying to do things, I think, to gear himself up. And I appreciate the fact that he's made those changes and he's really looking at this from a broad picture standpoint. But the thing that kind of gives me pause is not just how he's played, but also the one thing that I would say is a perceived weakness of Rory McIlroy's game is he still is not the greatest wedge player in the world. He has a real problem controlling the distances of his wedges. And on this golf course, with his driving prowess, when he puts himself in position to score, he's going to have to be really good because you can't airmail greens out here and miss long. And we see that miss often from Rory with a wedge in his hand. So I think of, you know, the big names that are there, he's easily top five most talked about as a guy that you would expect to win because of all the narrative around him. But given form and that one particular weakness, I've been sort of staying away from Rory. And honestly, guys, like, I hope I'm wrong on Monday because it would be so cool to see him win the career Grand Slam. But I think it's the easy one for me to say that Rory McIlroy is the guy I'd walk away from.
Okay, so the other side of it for you, Will Haskett, would be this. A guy that on paper looks like he's limping into the Masters, but, and I don't mean Tiger Woods, and I don't mean that in that regard, but you know what I'm saying? Somebody that people might not be talking about, but the course itself and a few things that maybe the player has tweaked of late that you've noticed lead you to believe that he is going to perform better in the Masters than he has in terms of recent play elsewhere. That would be who?
Yeah, he's been better, way better at the beginning of this year. So I think in golf circles, this wouldn't be a surprise, but he had such a bad year last year. I think to the casual observer, he really hasn't been in much of the conversation. That's Justin Thomas. He made the Ryder Cup team kind of somewhat controversially last year because he wasn't playing very well, had his worst season of his career. But his ball striking numbers are really good. This is, as we like to call it, a second shot golf course. You have to be really, really good with your irons to be successful at Augusta. Those numbers have been fantastic so far this year for JT. He has a fire and a desire to just sort of prove people wrong and to prove himself wrong. He made a caddy change at the last minute. He used to have Bones McKay, who was Phil Mickelson's longtime caddy in the bag. They parted ways last week. Which I actually think is good for JT. I think they were getting a little bit too chatty out there on the golf course, and it's time for him to just bear down and do things. So unlike past Masters, where I think Justin Thomas has been sort of a top five guy coming in, I feel like he's a little bit under the radar and certainly coming off a down season by his. And I'm a lot more bullish on JT this week than I think I was even on some of the years where he was playing better.
Will Haskett is our guest of PGA Tour Radio. Will, I want to give you just a couple of names that in your mind are, I don't want to say necessarily like good bets, but are good selections if you're just going to pick somebody to outright win the thing of people whose names that
I
I've
know
seen.
Who that's going
to
be.
Outside of, let me rephrase that, I guess best to come in second, since we know that's that Jake's right. selection is going to be the one putting correct. On the green jacket.
I'm so ready for this. I can't wait.
Me too. I'm as excited as you are. Me and Eddie have made two guesses. I'd like you to actually submit a guess as well before he reveals also. But people that could potentially win it that we haven't already talked about, John Rahm.
Of course, 100%. Yeah, I mean, he's in a weird spot, just sort of having to answer all these questions about why he left. And he's more recently talked about, hey, I want to see Liv make these changes. And I think if you're pro PGA Tour, you can read between the lines, and there's some buyer's remorse there. But it's hard to have buyer's remorse when you banked $500 million.
Will Zalatoris.
Sure. Man, he's a lot of strides this year and made a great debut. So yeah, he could probably do it. Sure.
For Victor Hovland.
No. You want to talk about a guy that's lost in the woods? He's made his third swing coach change in the last 3 months going into this week, which he is searching for it in so many ways right now. He could certainly find it. He's a world-class talent, but I mean, you want to talk about a guy that is unhappy playing golf right now. It feels like Victor Hovland still searching for something.
Couple more. Colin Morikawa.
No, he's down as of late. Like it's not the same superpower ball striker that we saw. So I think we got to wait for him to kind of rise back up to being a top 5-10 player in the world.
Xander Schauffele.
Yes, I expect him to be near the top of the leaderboard on Sunday. The question is he at the top and can he deal with that? Because we've seen a little bit of scar tissue develop in big tournaments with him of late.
Last one, we'll go Koepka.
Oh, yeah. Big game hunter. If it's a major and he's healthy, then Koepka should be top 5 or 6 on your board.
Is Tommy Fleetwood related to Mick? Do we know?
No, he's not.
He's not? Okay. Does he like their music? Do we know that?
He got the hair to go along with their music. He could headbang with them.
Does he do well with the ladies? Because I want to know if he's a Mac.
Yeah, wow. That's a little bit of a stretch. Hey, by the way, what did you think was the best U2 song of all time? I saw your... So your tweet last night.
You know, where's
your opinion?
Well, here's the thing. What is their best song and what is their most iconic are probably two different answers, right? But
sure. Yeah, I look like a music critic here. I mean, like best song is, I think, a little bit more.
Right. The one that friendly. I think it's interesting, Will, because, and I've done this with the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, and U2, because the reality is there are like 10 correct answers, right?
Yes.
I think that if you are, like, if U2, and I hate to say it in these terms, but sometimes, like, when somebody, like, posthumously, when you look back on, like, somebody in that moment, the song that would play, like, introducing the video of the career of U2, I feel like would be the intro to Pride in the Name of Love. Like,
yeah.
But,
you
know, I mean, they're like, I think you said Where the Streets Have No Name. I mean, it's hard to argue that with or without you.
In this country, I say streets in this country because of what that song meant post 9/11 at the Super Bowl. Like that to me is the most powerful song moment that U2 had for an American sports fan.
You know that With or Without You got, I think, the second highest number of votes behind Where the Streets Have No Name, but Pride in the Name of Love got a lot of votes, right?
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
I mean, amongst U2 fans, I think Bad would be the answer, but I think With or Without You or Where the Streets Have No Name. And it would have to be almost off Joshua Tree because that was their signature iconic 100%. Breakthrough mainstream album.
Or whatever the song was they wrote for that Batman movie that was terrible.
Anybody that says Beautiful Day is immediately exiled, along with the people that are barefoot on an airplane. Okay, here are my golfers, and then I will lead to my prediction of who's going to win the Masters. But I have three to ask you about first. You ready?
Please give me Thunder Bear. Please.
Minwoo Lee.
Oh, yeah. On the rise.
Thank you.
Incredible young talent.
Thank you.
Good pick. He may miss the cut, though.
But
I'm telling you.
That was like, a big glossing up and an undercut.
I mean, that is a home run of, I don't know, I'm trying to think of what the IndyCar equivalent would be at the Indy 500.
But, Santino Ferrucci.
There you go. Perfect. Okay. I like it.
Ludwig Neiman.
That's two different players.
No, it's not. Oh, wait, is it?
That's Ludwig Oberg or Joaquin Niemann.
That's I have Joaquin Niemann written right underneath it.
If you combine both golfers, could they win it?
Ludwig Aberg is what I said because he is the composer of golf, right?
Yeah, he incredible talent, great driver of the golf ball. He's a Masters rookie. I think Niemann is a big-time pick. I almost picked him to win the whole thing.
So Niemann was actually he's my place, but my winner. You ready for my winner?
Here we go. Me, I'm hanging up.
Eddie, if it's who?
Well, have you been to, let me see, Santiago, Chile?
Uh-huh. So next year at the winner's banquet, Chile will be served. You know why?
Because Niemann, the Chilean one? We already did the Niemann one, though.
No. Not a Chilean. Santiago de la Fuente. Santiago de la Fuente. Let me tell you guys laugh now. Laugh now, right?
I'm not laughing.
Thank you, Eddie.
I am.
Thank you. Listen,
he's an amateur, right?
Like he is
in college.
Okay. Theoretically he's an amateur, but you know, I mean, like 10 years ago, did you really think the point guard of Kentucky was an amateur? I mean, come on. Santiago de la Fuente is coming in. He has not one but two different amateur tournaments where he's been under a 65. He shot a 60 at one point. Now, granted, I think it was actually, to be honest with you, at the Cancun Putt-Putt, but that's okay. And he is right now at plus 250,000. You put down $20 on Santiago de la Fuente, you get 50 grand. That's the guy that's going to win the Masters.
I'd have to look it up. I don't know how many winners of the South American amateur, Latin American amateur, have made the cut since they gave him an exemption to the Masters. But maybe your guy makes the cut this year. I don't know. That's a tough one. Stick with Niemann. Take all that money you're going to bet on De La Fuente and put it on Niemann.
Listen,
because almost was my answer at the beginning of the show when you asked me who my pick was. My pick, by the way, is Hideki Matsuyama.
Oh, nice.
Jasper Stubbs. I mean, I like a guy that's named after both an engine and a barbecue sauce, right?
Okay. But, all right, here you go. I have no idea who that is.
Jasper Stubbs?
I have no idea who that is.
He's got a toe problem. But other than that, he has a really good chance, I'm telling you. But he is just two spots ahead in the odds of Santiago de la Fuente.
He must have won, like, the British Am. Honestly, I saw it today when I was looking at the field, and I'm embarrassed to say this on a mic, like, over the airwaves. I have no idea who
he
that
won
is.
The Brookshire tournament in Carmel last week.
It was in Jasper.
Oh, it was Jasper, my fault. Hey, what about Sam Burns?
Yeah, not the same golfer in level, and his wife's due any minute. So if she goes into labor, he's gone. So bet at your own risk.
Is that confirmed? I know it's a really weird question, but has he publicly said that? I have no idea. I'm just asking you.
Like, both he and Scottie Scheffler, who are best friends, they've rented a house together this week without their wives because their wives are at home. And Meredith Scheffler is due in, I think, 3 weeks. So we're feeling a little bit better. But Sam Burns' wife, I think her due date is like early next week. So if either one of them get a call, which is something to watch out for, I mean, Scheffler could be leading by 20 going into Sunday, and if Meredith goes into labor early, he's out of there.
Niemann, by the way, wins. I just looked this up. Joaquin Niemann is the clubhouse leader and the odds-on favorite to win in the NSDF category. That's the non-Santiago de Fuente category.
That's good.
Because he's going to win.
Do they have a setup, like, for hypothetically speaking, because I have no idea. You mentioned that his wife, Sam Burns' wife, is with him right now, is that right?
No, she's back in
Dallas. Okay, I was going to say, because if she was with him, like, does Augusta have a setup for that, where it's like, yeah, if it's a nighttime delivery, you're all good, we'll see you back out there at 8 a.m. tee time on Saturday. Like, it's literally all bets are off. Okay.
No, the PJ is fired up and ready to go back to Dallas if Meredith goes into labor.
All right. So my pick, Ludwig Aberg is my pick. It's going to come down to, basically, I don't know that there's necessarily going to be like a playoff for it. Ludwig's going to be right there, but Joaquin Niemann is the guy. That's if Santiago de Fuente, only if he gets homesick and goes home.
I'm taking Zalatoris.
Okay. I'm going to go with Niemann. Will, your pick, or do you not do picks?
No, Hideki Matsuyama is my pick, but Niemann was almost my pick, so I'm going to let you have Niemann, and then you can boast when the Niemann play actually happens. And if somehow your top three come true, again, Oberg Niemann top two is possible, but if De La Fuente is in there, then Chris Ballard's drafting a kicker. Like, that's what happens in the world.
I always forget. What's the Waste Management Open? Isn't that what it's called? That's like the big party that's gotten out of hand?
Yeah, I was there this year. Yeah.
Okay. So my understanding is Niemann is really good at that, right?
at Waste Management.
Where is that tournament? Where does it take place?
Scottsdale.
Yeah, which is Phoenix, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so naturally Joaquin should be good there. I'm just saying.
I see what you did there. Yeah, got it.
I'm telling you, that's who's going to win.
It's better than Stubbs.
Santiago De Fuente, though, I'm just mark my words. Will, we appreciate it. I'm sure this is probably 20 minutes of your life you'll never get back.
Could De La Fuente finish top 20? Like,
yes.
I want.
I don't think so.
Okay. All right.
I don't think so at all.
Okay.
Why? What do you have against him?
We've seen amateurs play well and maybe get top 20s in this tournament before, but there are a number of other amateurs like Christo Lamprecht, who's 6'8 stud from Georgia Tech, who was leading after round one of the Open Championship last year. Like, there are guys. Sam Bennett last year played well, still as an amateur before he turned pro. So we've got history of amateurs playing really well in this event, but it's going to be a tough week for your guy De La Fuente.
Okay, here's the thing. I'm predicting right now. Okay, like I said, Will, Nostradamus is my homie.
Yep.
2 years from now, I'm going to be, you know, just minding my own business around a peaceful afternoon, and my phone is going to blow up, and it's going to be because Santiago De La Fuente has won a tournament or is surging, and people are going to be like, oh my gosh, where have I heard that name
with
before?
You. Yeah,
correct.
I got it.
I'm always in front of it. Wasn't raining when Noah built the ark, man.
Don't you think they would know his name because he would have won the Masters at that point before they remembered? Oh yeah, Jake said that.
He's saying that Jake started the hype now.
Oh, okay.
Correct.
And then he eventually finds that success that Jake knew he was destined for.
I remember. Will, listen. You're a Washington Township guy. What middle school were you?
Eastwood.
Okay, exactly. As was I.
I'm sorry, wait, that's not what you call that place.
I remember, what's that?
That's not called Eastwood. What's it called, Jake?
Beastwood.
There we go, thank you.
Right. Well, listen, I was there. But when I was in 1989, people laughed at me because I kept telling them that the future of golf was a guy, and I picked it because his initials were EW, just like the baseball hat I had. And I said, EW, Eldrick. And he goes by Tiger, but his name's Eldrick. And everybody laughed at me. Who is this guy? Never heard of him. And I said, just wait. He was on Johnny Carson when he was little. He's going to be good. And here we are. That's who Santiago De Fuente is.
He was on Fallon?
That's right. Thanks, Will.
You're welcome. See you guys. Sorry.
We'll ask it.